Hey everyone. I was going to start this episode with some jokes making fun of the book. Then I found out some things about the backstory that made me feel like a real tool. But to take you on my journey, I'm still going to say the jokes. Today's book is The Alchemist by Paulo Coelho, which changed my friend's life, but which I think of as the book version of a cat poster. So today I'm going to try to not say stuff like, "What if you could read a placebo pill?"
I'm Kellen Erskine. I'm a comic, a father, and as an American, every time that I saw the phrase philosopher's stone in this book, I replaced it with sorcerer's stone. Isn't that crazy, though, with the first edition of Harry Potter in the United States, that when Penguin picked it up from J.K. Rowling, they were like, we're going to change it to sorcerer's stone. Because nobody here is going to know what a philosopher's stone is. And it's like, no, I don't think you know what that is.
They probably knew that American kids would see it and be like, I don't want to read about no Socrates. I read it as a kid and I had no idea what the Elixir of Life was. But as an adult, did you already know the connection between Elixir of Life and Philosopher's Stone?
Right. And so maybe that's a fair point with children. But yeah, my first experience with this was when I was 26. And at that point, yes, mortality had started to hit me. So I had already done my own personal research.
The Alchemist is a book about following your dreams no matter what.
And this is The Book Pile.
Jewel1205 said, I tried reading The Grapes of Wrath when I was 26 for fun. I couldn't get past page 4, feeling guilt until now.
The only way that Dave got past page 4 is by listening to it at 100 miles an hour.
And even then, barely. Finally, our next book is And Then There Were None. And it's a murder mystery, so you'll enjoy it a lot more if you've read the book by next week.
All right, and without further ado, here are 4 lessons that we took from The Alchemist. O Alchemista. I speak Portuguese. I'm kidding, I've forgotten most of it.
All right, lesson 1. Context is everything. I read this book, and its main message is to follow your dreams, and it repeats that many times. And I felt like this book is so oversimplified and it has some interesting points, but its main message is pretty obvious and there's not much complexity. And I looked down on it. Then I read Paulo Coelho's bio and it was this moment of, oh, I'm a bad person. When he was a teenager, his parents put him in a mental institution because he wanted to be an artist.
Oh, no.
In his 20s, he was kidnapped by the Brazilian dictatorship and tortured. Later in life, he was almost 40. He started pursuing his dream of being a writer and had success after many obstacles. So, is it okay for him to write a sweet, happy book without me being an ass about it? Also, this book about following your dreams came out in 1988. It's not his fault that in 2022, we've now had 40 years of the Disney Channel. I can sit here and say, follow your dreams isn't a revolutionary message because my parents never put me in an asylum for it.
Well, pardon me while I throw away most of what I prepared.
To be clear, I still have more jokes about the book. I just can't believe that I was eating my Trader Joe's, typing on my MacBook about how this torture victim doesn't know about the real world. I do think the danger of a comedy podcast is sometimes you read a sweet, hopeful, optimistic book, and then you remember insults are funnier than compliments.
I know that shock therapy has been used for a lot of things, but I had no idea that some parents have used it to change their kid's major. That is wild. I just want, like, what did they think was going to happen? He comes out of his therapy session like, okay, cool. Yeah, I don't want to draw anymore. All right. Lesson 2. In the desert, moving forward is the best way. So this whole story is basically a metaphor told of a boy making a journey to the pyramids to seek treasure. And at one point, as he's traveling with a caravan, a guide says to him, quote, once you're in the desert, there's no going back. And when you can't go back, you have only to worry about the best way to move forward. And obviously, we could get into how technically, if you're less than halfway to your destination across the desert, you really could go back. Uh-huh. It would probably be safer. But it's still solid advice. Like, instead of spending your days lingering on the past, the better move is to focus on the best way ahead, right? Even if it sucks, even if you're going through something terrible, like having to read a semi-motivational story about a kid in a desert, it's still the healthiest option.
Yeah, I would point out that oftentimes in the book, he gives advice that is sometimes true, as though it is always true.
Right. I certainly appreciate it over that whole Cortez's burn your ships message, which is oddly quoted by so many inspirational speakers. If you haven't heard it, when Cortez was trying to invade the Aztec Empire, the story is he burned all the ships that his army arrived in so that there was no turning back. They had no choice but to fulfill their personal legends and kill an entire country. And the lesson we're supposed to take from that story when Tony Robbins yells at you is to not have a plan B. Like, I feel like there are so many other options to choose from. So, yeah, I like this fake desert story better than the one about real genocide. And also, isn't the actual message behind burn your ships that if you're having trouble with hesitant employees, just threaten them all with death? I've never understood like the starving artist mentality. I get it if you're actually poor, but I have known a number of comics who are like, I quit my job, that way I had to make it in comedy. And it's like, but couldn't you just really want it and try and get it anyway?
It's very probable for those friends that the thing holding them back isn't their motivation. It's either their skill set or that they haven't worked long enough to get that lucky break.
Right.
And so quitting your job does not really help you on either of those things.
One time someone messaged Norm Macdonald on Twitter asking him, should I quit my day job to pursue comedy? And Norm Macdonald responded with, comedy is an 8-to-12 job. You can keep your 9-to-5.
Mm. All right, lesson 3. Does manifesting work? Here's the key quote of the book. And when you want something, all the universe conspires in helping you to achieve it. By itself, I don't think that's true. Would you ever say to someone dumped by the love of their life, I guess you didn't want it enough? And I think those kinds of oversimplifications were why I had a hard time with the book. But I texted my Uncle Pete about why he liked it, and he said, I liked the positive vibe that while we shouldn't cling to expectations, we can trust that the nature of our universe rewards patient, hopeful effort. The law of the harvest permeates our existence even if we don't always connect the dots, and often not in the most anticipated manner. And I realized, I think I liked that more than the book. But I want to ask, Kellen, do you think manifesting works?
I don't think it does. I also don't have anything against someone who has attributed, even if it's falsely in my mind, things coming together sort of in this magic way. If anything, the opposite has happened to me during most of my career.
Wait, what do you mean?
I mean, imagine finally, after 15 years of pursuing your dream, you get 3 TV credits in a year, you start selling tickets at comedy clubs, and then the universe gives the entire world a disease.
It must not like your material.
So I am all for positivity, but I do think the idea of manifesting something, it's a little too hocus pocus for me.
I think I concluded that if your manifesting gets you to take action, it probably helps. And if it doesn't, it's probably counterproductive. Mm. I heard someone describe manifesting this way, and it might have been Scott Adams. Sort of that idea of you close your eyes, you think of the color red, and you open your eyes and you see red everywhere. And so if you're manifesting something, maybe you're more likely to spot the opportunities as they arise or that kind of thing.
I think manifesting has a lot of meanings for a lot of people. Where I start to back away from the edge is like when Jim Carrey talks about manifesting, he said at one point he stared into the Pacific Ocean from his house in Malibu, concentrated, and then dolphins jumped out of the water.
Maybe he's actually in the Truman Show. The best way to hide from someone that they're in the Truman Show is to let them make a movie called The Truman Show.
I think this is where I'm getting at, is that Jim Carrey is very much into manifesting. I think the problem is when someone very successful also has a weird theory, it can give credibility to maybe something that isn't true, like Scientology.
Because sure. We don't hear from the manifestors who failed.
Exactly. Yeah. We just hear from the manifestors who do all their own stunts.
It's like that. One last quote on this idea comes from James Clear, who says, if you know where you want to go in life, people tend to help or get out of the way. Both are useful.
All right. Lesson 4. Sometimes a book gets inexplicably lucky. So in an interview with Oprah Winfrey, the author said that the way his book became successful was that he went to a second publisher after his book flopped, literally knocked on the door of this guy's house and said, hey, my book bombed, but I know it can do better. And then that guy at that house said, okay, I'll publish it. And then it sold 70 million copies.
Wow.
Now, if that's how simple a success story can be, why did it take him 300 pages to tell us just to live our dreams? Also, I just plain don't believe him. It seems like he skipped a few steps in his explanation, and I honestly want to know the full story. First of all, I lived in Brazil for a couple of years, and you don't knock on people's doors. You clap at their gates. And rich people never just come out to see who's there, much less someone who's like, excuse me, I wrote a poorly received allegorical novel. Could I have a word? And again, like I'm happy for any force for good. I'm happy for anyone who read this and was inspired to live better. But I genuinely don't know why this book did so well. I am stumped. I do have a couple quick theories, though. My first theory is that in the story of The Alchemist, both Christianity and Islam are equally true, which is probably a good move if you're trying not to alienate half the world. But it still doesn't explain why it was so appealing to so many people, especially after it didn't catch on after its first run. I do think maybe there's something to say for vague pseudo-religious Hallmark movie philosophy in that you can't really argue with it. Along with what you were saying earlier, Dave, it's like trying to debate with one of those motivational office posters, because the poster's like, follow your dreams. And you're like, yeah, but there are probably certain steps you can take to. And it's like, believe in yourself. And you're like, sure, that helps too. And then it's like, now turn into the wind. And you're like, okay, I don't know where to go from here.
I mean, it might just depend on context. Like, if my parents had put me in an asylum for wanting to be an artist, and I read this book, it would probably be a revelation.
But do you really think there are 70 million people out there who have never heard Follow Your Dreams?
Yes.
You think so? Also, in my making fun, I'm not trying to convince anyone even not to read this book, because obviously it has affected so many people for the good. I just sincerely don't know how it sold more copies than so many other great self-help books out there.
It's also possible that we're in the thick of, oh yeah, we're chasing the dream, and it's a lot harder than this. It's a lot more complicated than just wanting it. I don't know. I don't have a great answer.
I think it's likely something that has to do with like what we read about in that Contagious book. Like, I don't think we brought up the story of the hula hoop, which was invented in the 50s, sold a few thousand. And then that Alvin and the Chipmunks Christmas song came out. And the next year they moved 15 million.
No way.
Because of a cartoon chipmunk song. Because
like Theodore says, me, I want a hula hoop or
That's
something
it.
Like
it's
that.
It's just that line. Yeah.
I hope the next year Alvin was like, this year I want an Audi. Start taking like product placement deals.
Songs. Oh, that would be amazing. Eventually they just get lazy with it and start with, me, I want a Folgers coffee.
All right, random facts. I know I knocked on this book, so I do want to include some of my favorite aphorisms. He says, and when each day is the same as the next, it's because people fail to recognize the good things that happen in their lives. I read that great quote about gratitude and I thought, how can I find an exception to this rule so that when I say it, I will appear special? He says, once again, he saw that in that strange land, he was applying all the lessons he had learned with his sheep. All things are one, the old man had said. Last one, whoever has money is never really alone.
I forgot that one. My version of that is whoever owns a truck thinks at first that they have more friends, but then they find out that people just want help moving.
At one point, the boy has a crush on this girl, and he's scheming about how he's going to shear some sheep in front of her so she knows he can do hard things. He's also going to tell her some stories he learned from books, but since she can't read, he's going to tell them like they're his stories. And it's relatable because there was an era of my life when if I liked a girl, I was always thinking, how can I, without being obvious, work into this conversation as many of my accomplishments as possible?
At one point in the story, the alchemist guide character advises the boy, who's the main character. He says, sell your camel. Camels walk thousands of paces without seeming to tire. Then suddenly they kneel and die. Buy a horse. And at that point, I was just wondering, like, is this still part of the allegory? Is it just a desert hack? I'm wondering, again, if maybe this story is so popular for the same reason that The Old Man and the Sea is so great to me, because it's written in like a vague way where I really did find meaning in a lot of moments that perhaps Hemingway did not even intend.
Uh-huh. Kellen, I want to play another game of, is this quote from the book or from an AI? Mm. All right, here we go. Everything that happens once can never happen again.
I remember that from this book.
Oh, dang it.
Because it doesn't make sense.
All right. One for one. Don't give in to your fears. If you do, you won't be able to talk to your heart.
Is that AI?
That's Coelho.
Okay.
You should be a fool.
I don't think a computer would say that. I'm going to say it's the book.
That's an AI. All right, one for three.
That just sounds like one that's trying to trick us. You should be dumber than machines are.
When you are loved, there's no need at all to understand what's happening.
Hmm. That just sounds like a controlling boyfriend, but I'm going to say that's from the book.
That is from the book. All right, you're 50-50. And yeah, it does sound like he's been caught with someone else. Keep in mind that you are fed up with the world and don't forget that nothing lasts forever.
Oh, it's just also, I'm going to say that's the book.
That's an AI.
Again, I should have known that was a robot. It's like, remember, nothing lasts forever except for me.
Before the impossible comes the pain.
I don't remember that from the book, so I'm going to say it's an AI.
That's an AI. All right, 50-50. And it's funny you were saying these AI takeover quotes, because while I was getting those quotes, all of a sudden the AI went totally dark. Here's some of the things it said. The two things you need in order to get crucified is balls and some kind of accident.
What?
And then, Kellen, look at the images it sent me. One is a murder victim. Another looks like the girl from The Ring. One is a photo of Nietzsche that just says, one man's joy, another man's flesh.
Cool.
I felt like I was watching the AI go rogue.
So what is this generator that you're using?
It's just called InspiroBot.
Okay, cool. Because I'm going to use it to write a sequel to The Alchemist. So Coelho at one point is quoted as saying, seldom do I find that film adaptions of books work well. And then I did more research and found that he sold the movie rights for $250,000. Saying, I'll take the money, but I'm not going to like it. I don't have a joke for this, but I did enjoy this moment where he's basically halfway through his journey. It says of the boy, right now he was content just to look at the trees. The treasure of the pyramids was still in the future, and one day this oasis would be a distant memory. But right now, it was the present moment. Life is the moment we're living right now.
Hmm.
And now I'm going to make fun of it. So at one point, the main character, the boy, says, if he ever wrote a book, it would present the people one at a time so that the reader wouldn't have to memorize a lot of names. I think this is just like the author injecting his own like opinions. Because in this book, only three of the characters have names. And even then, they're still just like named once and afterward referred to as the boy, the girl, the British man. I did think that it was a delightful part of the story where the journey brings the boy to the pyramids just to get beat up by a guy who ends up inadvertently giving him his final clue to where the treasure is. Mm-hmm. And when the boy asks the universe, I think it was the universe, either that or that dirty king who can turn into a rock. I get some of the spiritual guides mixed up. Anyway, when he asks, why didn't you just send me straight to the treasure? The answer he gets back is, I could have told you directly where to go, but then you wouldn't have seen the pyramids. Weren't they beautiful? I just thought it was a wonderful way of showing how there is beauty along that zigzag path to whatever your goal is.
It'd be like if Frodo gets to the end, finds out Mount Doom is in the Shire, and Gandalf's like, but I wanted you to see the mountains.
And also, I did appreciate that instead of this being another story where the twist is the treasure was inside you the whole time, that there really was treasure. But we're also given the message that each of us can find our own treasure. So it's a little confusing. It's like you didn't present that part as a metaphor. So am I supposed to? The point is, after I read this book, I bought a metal detector.
And after writing this book, Paulo Coelho made a ton of money. So
I guess technically he did get beat up before getting millions of dollars.
Oh, gosh.
I go back to Tina Fey's Not For Me, But Good For You, which sounds a little too condescending than I actually mean it. Because it's hard to say good for you without sounding like you're on a pedestal.
Sure.
But I really do mean it. Like I said, I found meaning in Old Man and the Sea. You found meaning in a book about it where the main character is a seagull. So we all have... We all have our alchemists.
All right, to recap, our favorite lessons from The Alchemist. One, context is everything. Two, in the desert, moving forward is the best way. Three, does manifesting work? Four, some books get inexplicably lucky.
And five, again, I mean this in the least condescending way. If this book inspired you, good for you.